Ladies and gentlemen, well done, well done. Good afternoon, welcome to the Press Club lunch for this week. We've had quite a few this year. My name is Rex Jory. I'm a member of the Press Club board, and I was appointed to chair this meeting 8 minutes ago. But I knew that it wasn't Peter Nixon who was the guest speaker. Welcome to everyone, to those new faces in the room, and there's always one or two, as well as many old faces, particularly in this table over here, but we won't go into the age area. There's Bildo over there. He fits into that category as well. Welcome to you all. I'd like to acknowledge our major sponsor, Telstra, but also Jeff Timms. Jeff, you're here today. Jeff is one of our major sponsors and one of Adelaide's best-known independent jewellers. I'd also like to welcome Gay Thompson, the member for Rennell, Elizabeth Bolton, the Chief Magistrate, and of course, our guest, Christine Nixon. Christine hasn't told me this, but I'm sure she will be prepared to sign some books afterwards. Many of us would have read the reviews, and there's a lot in it for everyone, I'm sure, whether your interests are police or whatever. They'll be going at a special cut rate, I think $37, and Christine will be happy after the lunch to sign those. As I say, I'd like to acknowledge Telstra and Jeff Timms, but also today we're drinking, and I had intended to drink more, but now that I've got this job, I can't. The Jacobs Creek variety of wines, which are well known to us all, and SA Brewing, as ever, are with us today, they're one of our great supporters. On your table, please, there are raffle books and three for $5. It's the raffle that really keeps our head above water. We try to keep our costs down, and the raffle's the thing that allows us to sometimes go into the black, but that doesn't happen as many times as it should. So anyone who feels the way, Jeff Timms is the number one donator here today, and there are some other good prizes which, I suppose I can go through them now. Jeff's donated a voucher of $300. There's two cartons of beer from SA Brewing. There are two bottles of wine. In fact, there are five prizes, so with a crowd of this big, I think there's every chance that you'll walk away with a dozen bottles of wine or some beer or even Jeff Timms voucher. I'm going to come back shortly to introduce our guest speaker, but for the time being, please enjoy your food and the Jacobs Creek wine. I'll be back soon after 1:30. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, could I gradually wear you down and get your attention, please? Well done, well done. Wish I had that control at home. We're here today to hear Christine Nixon, and if there's one person in the room that doesn't know that the outline of the Christine Nixon story, I'd be surprised. Last week I had lunch with a couple of gangsters, Nigel Hunt from the Sunday Mail and Bildstein and one or two others, and Peter Alexander from the former president of the Police Association turned up. And you always know you're having a bad lunch if Peter Alexander turns up. And we were talking about Christine and her role in not only the bushfires, which are probably the signature, but also her rise and rise in the Victorian Police Force, which is a remarkable story from for a girl whose father was in the police force and who rose to the very top of the police force in Victoria. And he was a man inspired by that story, and I think it's only a small part of the book, the inspiration of Christine Nixon rising up through the ranks of the Victorian police force. And we were just talking about the elements of it, about crisis days, that this town is just as likely to experience as Victoria did 3 or 4 years ago. Anyone who drives into the hills after the wet winter we've had and says, why would you want to live here, would be on the right track, I'm sure. And we must, and there are lessons in this book about that problem, and there are lessons that this room and probably this media should also take to the people before we get too much closer to the summer. But that's another story for another day, I guess. But it is something that after what, since the 1980s, nearly 30 years since we've had a terrible bushfire season, yet Victoria, the experience in Victoria tells us that it is inevitable, just like, dare I say it, just like the stock market will go up one day. But that's another story entirely, isn't it? Christine's father, of course, was in the police force, and so, as in my house, I used to bring home the issues of journalism. Christine's father, Ross, used to bring home issues of policing, and as we've read, she was doing amazing things like bringing stolen weapons in from the car into the house, and all those things that police do, Christine as a child was had the experience of doing, and that was one of the catalysts to take her to the top in the police force. And her rise in the police force is in itself an inspiration, not only within the police community, but also within the community itself, that in a time perhaps more difficult than today, she was able to beat the bureaucracy, beat the opponents in the police force, I'm sure, probably beat the politicians, to rise to that terrific position. And her battles were, yes, with the criminals, but also with these other elements. I might say, before I hand the microphone to Christine, that the books are going, because I was sitting next to her and I couldn't get a conversation because Christine's got writer's cramp, already signing, and she's happy to do it. But they will be for sale afterwards. But to tell you a little more about her great book, Fair Cop, here's Christine Nixon. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to come along and to talk about the book. At the end, I'm also happy to answer any questions if you wanted to. I'm always happy to answer journalists' questions, and I've been doing that for a long part of my life. The book, well, before I start, I wanted to also recognise our distinguished guests in the room, and lovely to see you both here, and to all the others who are here. Can also pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, and to their elders past and present. The book is one that I started to think about writing when I had announced my resignation from Victoria Police back in November 2008. And a couple of reasons struck me why it would be an important thing to write about. One was that I had witnessed, I think, an enormous change in policing that had gone on from, in a sense, the 60s and then through to my sort of retirement date. And I thought it was important that the community came to understand actually what had happened and from an insider's perspective. The second piece, people approached me and said, Christine, from someone who started out as a 19-year-old in the New South Wales Police when there were 130 other women only and 8,000 men, to have actually got to the point where you became the Chief Commissioner for Victoria Police, that's a story in itself of a whole range of experiences and, I suppose, skills and other sorts of capacities that might get you to be able to then to be a Chief Commissioner as well. So the book was kind of underpinned by that. We started on it, and then, of course, along came the Victorian bushfires in 2009, and I became the chair of the Victorian Bushfire Recovery and Reconstruction Authority, and we stopped the book for most of the time that I was in that role, and then started again. So the book, I think, travels over three sort of aspects in some ways, and so with the background I've given you, it is about what I wanted to say. And there are some chapters in there that I know are controversial, but decided that I wanted to say it with my collaborator, Joe Chandler. The second is, what did people want to hear? And we felt it was important. There were various issues people had raised and other kinds of things that perhaps really hadn't actually ever been explained to the community about some things that had happened in Victoria and perhaps broader issues. And the third and the most important one is the one that what were the lawyers let us say? This book is extraordinarily covered by lawyers and has been for some time. And partly that's about some of the issues that are discussed there. Some of it is around cases that were ongoing. And even to the very day before it was to be printed, we found a suppression order on a particular matter that we had to withdraw part of what we'd written about. So to make sure that I didn't breach any kind of issues that were relevant to the courts and also as my role as Chief Commissioner. So the lawyers have had an interesting time with this book. And so what we've said in the end is the outcome of all of that. The themes, I think, through it are really around policing and change, around women and achievement, around politics and policing. And there is a particular chapter which I'm sure some of you will find interesting, which is called Managing the Media and Other Myths. And my experience really in that goes through from when I was much younger in policing and some of the times we've sort of worked through. But it also does go back, and what I wanted to do is just read a couple of extracts from it to give you a sense of the kind of story it might be. This is the prologue and, starts obviously with, I'm a child of a rare time, raised in the lull between a world war and a social revolution. I was born into one reality and grew to inherit quite another. Part of a demographic king tide of baby boomers who washed up across Sydney's northern beaches in the 1950s. I was raised in a place where the streets of the new suburbs were unsealed, where the doors to the new houses lining them were unlocked, and where children were free to roam and play, watched over by a village. Where in the early days, we didn't have a car or a television, and we did have a weekly visit from the dunny cart man. Where we children were instilled with values and manners of a vanishing era. At the risk of a cuff across the ear, we would later use these values to navigate our way across the shifting social landscape. So that era, really the 50s, when my parents were creating a community, my parents were both in the Second World War. And only when I started to write this book did we think about the influence that they had on me and the difference in some ways to the communities that we now live within. They were building our community, my parents, and they were also building children, three of us, over time, to take our place in the world. And I think in many ways my parents equipped us well to be able to do that. So the story starts there, and one of the opening chapters is when Ross met Betty. And my parents, both Second World War. My father had been in a Corvette and my mother had been in an army hospital and had worked through that, and talks about the era that they went through. And so the early part of the book, lays out that kind of a foundation of the experiences that they had. And I think it's worthwhile to think about that baby boomer generation. There are some people here, some of you are a bit young for that generation, but it was an interesting time, and I think the baby boomers have made an amazing impact. The story then goes on to talk about my time eventually becoming a young police constable in New South Wales. As I said, when very few women, my registered number in New South Wales is 173. I mean, it's from 1915 when they first hired women into the New South Wales Police, and I was hired in 1972. And apparently there are some women they didn't give numbers to, but there only had been 173. Because the interesting piece about when they hired women in New South Wales, South Australia was actually not far after that at a similar time in hiring women. But in New South Wales, they hired women so that they could look after the moral standards of New South Wales. And they hired two. I knew we were pretty good, but I didn't think we were that good. And so it tracks through that 70s and I think the time around what happened to I think, women and a whole range of others during that sort of 70s and 60s and 70s when a lot of people in our community, I think, came to the view that they didn't want to put up with what they had, this kind of the way of the world was at that stage. And so the book sort of tracks through that time. The stories that Rex raised about my father, and my father was a ballistics expert and one of, I think, a generation of what I think would now be described as change agents in policing. And so those firearms that he brought home, the photographs of murders that he would bring home and were part of the sort of environment we grew up in, were just part of, you know, the way it was. And the firearms were put under the bed so no one stole them from the car, as he, you know, would have to take him back to work the following day. And cars were so rare, and I think that sort of part of, for me, was that experience. My father, when I joined the police, wasn't all that happy. He felt like I would have two problems. Actually, it turned out they had three. One of them was that I was only 5 foot five and a half, and you have to be 5 foot six to join the New South Wales Police. He hadn't quite anticipated that problem, but turned out it wasn't all that significant, and I managed to get in when I stood up very tall. Because in those days, only about 3% of women were actually over 5 foot six. And if you were between 20 and 30 as well, you even narrowed the category, so that was another issue. The second point is he thought, made enemies during policing, and he thought also the third part was I would be bored with the kind of roles that women were able to get involved in those days. But I went in, and I suppose in 1976 was part of a change process in New South Wales Police. In my experience I describe here as working at Darlinghurst Police Station. Some of you would know it, some of you would not. But in 1970s in Darlinghurst, it was near the end of the Vietnam War. It was a place where 300 to 400 people a night would be arrested in Darlinghurst Police Station, arrested in that area and taken to the station. We were sent there, 300 women and 400 men, as a sort of a trial for women in operational policing. I'm sure we were sent because it was supposed to fail, but as it turned out, that wasn't the case at all. And so that goes through the experience at Darlinghurst, and I think for me, recognising a series of people and giving me the early sort of understanding about the varieties of people who are in our community, and the book talks through that. It then, I guess, goes through times within New South Wales. Eventually, I make my way to be an assistant commissioner. In 1994, I was the first female to become an assistant commissioner in the New South Wales Police. And 3 days later, they announced the Royal Commission, the Wood Royal Commission, into the New South Wales Police. It wasn't my fault. It was, though, I have to say, I was one of about 30 senior police who went to Parliament the day it was announced and stood with the Commissioner at the time and the Police Minister, who suggested that if we were down there, perhaps we could convince the politicians not to run a Royal Commission. I still have, you know, grave concerns about having ever done that, but that's what happened. And they did, in fact, run the Royal Commission, and actually I was giving a presentation the other day and Justice James Wood came along, person who chaired that commission. But we had 3 years worth of a Royal Commission into the New South Wales Police, and it was an important part eventually of bringing about quite dramatic change. So my time then as an assistant commissioner, Peter Ryan, was part of that. He became the commissioner and I worked with him for some time, and eventually one of the chapters says, and thank you Peter Ryan, because he sent me out to work in an operational region. I had some interesting relationships with him, but eventually I went out and worked in operations, and then the story moves along to coming to Victoria in 2000, or going to Victoria in 2001. And the story then, I guess, much of the rest of the book really concentrates on that particular point in time. I think the book through the Victorian years talks about how you change a major organisation. And I know that I have my critics, and I do make comments about a couple of those critics in the book. Some of them have been extraordinarily consistent. From the very beginning, I've done nothing that they thought was suitable or acceptable, and they've said so. And at least you know where people are consistent. That's good. You know, you can understand them. But the point about the change in Victoria, I came as an outsider, and it talks about what that's like as a young, relatively young female coming from north of the border to become the police commissioner, and then actually working with a very big, I think very significant organisation in our community to try and do a simple thing, to make that organisation the best it could be. That's all. I wasn't trying to do anything else. It was simply about trying to make it the best it could be and to be able to work with the various people in our community so that they too would think that that organisation met its needs and expectations. One of the themes that goes through the book is a notion of, I guess, a model called force or service. And back in the 80s, I worked with a man called John Avery, who became the police commissioner in New South Wales, and he started me on this model. Actually, it was early 70s, really, late 70s. And he wrote a book called Police Force or Service. And the arguments that I suppose much of my career and still resonate out there in policing is around whether we're supposed to be a force and all that's about, or whether they're supposed to be a service to our community. My view, obviously, is we're a service. We can be as tough as anybody else when we need to be, and we can have all the firearms and all the firepower you want to have, and that's a piece of it. But the rest of it, in the main, is about how you work with communities and how you meet their needs. So the book talks about that model. I followed that model much of the time, and when I got to Victoria, then started to talk to the members and the community about what they wanted from their organisation. Victoria costs their community $2 billion a year to run, and we need to be accountable to the community. And I think that was an important part of understanding what did communities want, what did the government want from us. So it talks about that era of working through the very early days of meeting thousands of police officers and administrative professional support staff and asking them what they wanted us to do. So it's a story of change, and I think successful change. People will say, well, nothing happened in Victoria Police. They clearly can't have been the same place I was, because I think a lot of things happened during the time I was there. Not long after I'd started, we had 9/11. I remember waking up and being called by my deputy commissioner and said, turn television on. And policing in many ways is, many of our communities never been the same since. And for a whole range of reasons, that impacted on us across this whole country. And a chapter talks about policing terrorism, and some of the views I express in there are not ones that the Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, would have agreed with. I didn't think we should frighten our communities. I think we needed evidence, we needed intelligence, we needed to understand what was happening in our communities, and we needed to have the community as part working with us. And particularly, we didn't need to demonise particular aspects and groups in our community, and that's the sort of important part I think I wrote about. It goes through then to the underworld, which I'm sure you'd want to look at. I don't know if you read the Underbelly things. This is a bit different to that. And even if you saw Underbelly, actually. But the only thing I thought about Underbelly in the end is that we won. That was the important part. The Underbelly really does talk about, what happened, and I think it was, a particular aspect I thought I might read just a short paragraph, which really was the point when we'd had a number of shootings, but mostly people had thought, well, it's just crooks shooting each other. What's the big deal? I never thought that, and I knew that we were being undermined whilst that continued. Everything changed with the underworld casualties 15 and 16. These were the executions, one Sunday morning in June 2003, of amphetamine profiteer and thug Jose Moran and his mate and minder Pasquale Barbaro, shot dead in front of children, including Moran's six-year-old twins, while they were attending a junior football clinic in Essendon. People started to say, shit, this is serious. Innocents were being damaged in this conflict. All the horrified children and citizens of Essendon Football Ground that day became the casualties of the war. And I think at that point, Victoria Police had to admit that we dropped the ball, that we needed to do much better than we were doing in terms of how we actually figured out how to stop this and how to then proceed forward. And so the underworld war talks about, first of all, where it started, why it started. Again, not known to many people for a long time because of suppression orders on a particular arrest that occurred, and that, in effect, when the person got arrested, took out their whole network, it left a vacuum. And into the vacuum came people that some of you came to know, Carl Williams and Mario Condello and the Carlton crew and the Moran dynasty and all of those people became part of that process. So I think audience, and one of the parts says, audience were intrigued but not particularly disturbed by the ongoing drama. News footage of bizarre funerals where mourners carry on like Godfather caricatures. And we came to know a range of people. It talks about what happened in that. Then it talks about the issues I've had with the police association called the State of the Union, and works through those issues. The chapter I mentioned on managing the media and other myths, goes back to my very early days as a young police officer at Darlinghurst, being one of the, as I said, one of the first three women walking down our street with their handbags, and on the front page of one of the papers was the Darlings of Darlow. That was a start. I remember going into the police station and there was this lovely pot plant there, and we would had pictures taken with the pot plant. I never saw that pot plant again after that. It goes on to the time I won a scholarship to go to Harvard University and was interviewed by a journalist, and he said to me, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I was 33 years old at the time. I said, "I'm pretty grown up." And he said to me, "Well, what do you want to be?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, maybe the police commissioner." And he said, "There's no way in the world you can be a police commissioner." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, you just can't. You're a woman." I went, "Yep, I understand. Been one for a while, actually." And he said, "Well, there's no way in the world. They'll never let you." And so that was his sort of comment. The fellow who was interviewing me, you know, we talked through a range of issues, and I made one fundamental error, which I have to say many of us who've ever been interviewed, you know, sometimes you'll read it and your stomach just goes, "Oh, no, I couldn't have said that," or "I wish I hadn't said it," or "Maybe I didn't even say it." But in this case, I said it. The reason I wanted to be the police commissioner, of course, the one we've got is not very good. And there it was in a double-page spread in a national newspaper. And I went to, you know, wake up to yourself, Christine. And so it talks then about my experiences. Much has been made lately about some of the more recent issues I've had with a particular news organisation. But most of the time, actually, I from there on as a chief commissioner, I think I had a positive relationship. It's a very important relationship that police have with the media for both sides. And it has to be ethical, it has to be properly handled, it has to be properly managed, and we can both, I think, learn enormous amounts from that. But I do make some points in here, and I think it's partly, in some cases, I guess I make the point about fear. And just to read a little around that, because I think what happens sometimes is some of the commentators we have manage to make our people in our communities afraid, and that bothers me enormously. And just one part. Fear twists the game because it muzzles the voices of good people. Fear allows the powerful to keep the powerless quietly in their place. Fear spooks many people out of action, allowing the loudmouths to dominate the pitch and set the parameters of the debate. And so I've quietly devoted a lot of my professional life, I hope, to motivating people through words and actions to find courage, to not be afraid, to speak up. And I think it's we stop a lot of people from speaking up, because what will people say about me? It could be people you know, and in some cases it could be media commentators. One particular Sydney media commentator and I have never got on. When I was a regional commander, he used to send me letters. He has a habit of doing this. And he would send me letters asking me to explain certain behaviours or something in my region, and I refused to respond. And I remember getting calls from headquarters saying, "You have to respond to him. We listen to him every day and he's very important." And I said, "I don't care. I'm not responding to him." And I have to say, since all that time, he's never said a decent word about me yet. And I don't really care. And I think the book goes on to talk about some other issues about being a police commissioner when a police officer dies and what that feels like. And it's a terrible thing when you have to be the one to stand up and give a eulogy for a police officer who's only young and his five-year-old son runs around in front of you. It talks about losing police officers like we did Paul Carr, who was the most amazing man, and how we try to get his body back from China and the kind of ways and means you do that. We had a number of policemen across Australia and other community members who were killed in an Egyptian bus crash, and we talk about how we managed to work through that. So it gives people an insight, I hope, into what that was like to try and do that. And then we come to Black Saturday and talks about what I did on the day in some detail. And then, of course, the chapter on the Royal Commission is much longer perhaps than it should be, but it's 15,000 words. And I felt if Joe and I didn't write it, then all people would do was talk about it anyway. So I figured at least I got to put my own view about what happened on that. And just to conclude, and then I'm happy to answer questions, the final part talks about rebuilding, recovery and renewal. And just one example of this is the day after the bushfires, and I was in Whittlesey. I went up very quickly in the morning to go and understand, get a sense for myself about what it would look like and what had happened. In Whittlesey, one day soon after the fires had passed, I came across an old woman wandering near the crowded chaos at the emergency relief centre. She looked shocked and bedraggled, and her feet were bare and filthy with ash. "We'll get you some shoes," I told her in my most reassuring tones, dropping a comforting hand on her shoulder "Why," she said, looking at me quizzically, "I haven't worn shoes for 20 years. Here was my lesson. Never assume you know what people want or need. And so the book goes on then through that chapter to talk about some of the people I met, and just one of them. There was Ange Gordon from Traralgon South, who used her great skills as a teacher to figure out how to help her community. The citizens of Strathewen were well served by their Community Renewal Association, headed by Malcolm Hackett. They quickly identified their priorities, rebuilding the school, re-establishing a cricket club, setting up a community centre and set to work. Small communities know that if they wait on others to move for them, they will wait a very long time. And it talks about the kind of way we worked in the rebuilding and reconstruction of our communities. And I'm still involved and still chair the bereaved committee and help those people who lost loved ones to be able to deal with it and also make a difference in communities. And the final bit finishes with a lesson to learn. And it draws from my experience over 40 years or so of understanding that history is important, that nobody ever does anything alone. It's about partnerships. Sometimes you'll learn a lot by just getting back a bit and thinking about what's going on around you. That resilience is pretty important. I have a wonderful mother I talk about a fair bit in the book, and she has a great line. So if all else fails, Christine, you can come home. My mum's 87, and I'm 58. So, but those kind of things, the support you get, about setting goals, about most of us actually don't set goals in our lives, and neither do organisations. That we just wander along sometimes and not really thinking about what we're trying to achieve individually and in big organisations. And coming into Victoria Police, moving into the Bushfire Authority, one of the important parts I saw is we needed to set goals. We needed to figure out how to get things done. It also talks about power and how you use it, about respecting people. And I suppose the last bit talks about be yourself, because everybody else is taken. That's the book. Thanks very much. Happy.
It was music to my ears that Christine said, "I'm happy to take questions." We have had speakers who have come to the press club and said, "Oh, I'm not going to answer questions," but and I'm sure that Christine has heard them all. I'd be fascinated to see whether the media and others can throw a question at her that she hasn't had.
Oh, thanks.
It is now open to the media and others to ask Christine.
Sure.
Well, I'm going to disappoint Christine. Michael Owen from The Australian. I'm going to ask you a question that you've probably been asked a lot of times, because you seem to gloss over that today, and it's probably one of the reasons a lot of us are here. I mean, how often do you think about your decision on Black Saturday to go out for dinner rather than stay at that command post?
I suppose during the time of after the bushfires, I worked as the chair of the Bushfire Reconstruction Recovery Authority flat out for a long period of time and didn't think a lot about that decision at all. I was then called before a Royal Commission 14 months after the fires, and I assume the Royal Commission had understood what everybody had done. They'd interviewed people for 139 days, I believe, and so my understanding was I was there to talk about what the roles were that people had in the day, the emergency management systems, and also the recovery and reconstruction, which had been going on for 14 months. So I suppose we then get to the Royal Commission and various questions are asked, and then the media asks other sorts of questions. And so I suppose, you know, I then had to think about, and I say so in the book actually, that I really, the person who started writing this book is not the one who finished it. And I think a lot of that is thinking about that issue. You know, I was questioned on the time. I've talked to lots of people in the bushfire communities and wondered about, you know, whether my presence would have made any difference at all. Whether the style of leadership and management I have, which is really about delegating. And I was talking to a fellow who worked for me in the Commonwealth Games, and he was reminding me last night that we met the Queen, and he was saying to me that the Queen came up and said, "Christine, you were responsible for the security at the Commonwealth Games." And I said, "Actually, this man here was the one responsible. I'm his boss, and he did the job." You see, that's the model. People don't like it, but that's the model. And you run a big organisation of $2 billion and 14,000 people. You put your trust in people, and those people I put my trust in did not let me down. Nobody criticised Victoria Police. They criticised me for not being there. I understand it. I've apologised to the people of the community and the people who count in the bushfires.
Just one more question. In terms of getting to police commissioner, you obviously had to play the politics and also work very closely with the media because of the position.
Hmm.
Why then, when you left the job, did you turn on the media, or sections of the media? Well, in fact, the whole media you seem to have turned on. What, is it because you no longer needed them, they no longer needed you, the relationship broke down?
No, I think what happened was that I actually left the Victorian Reconstruction and Recovery Authority and worked as a volunteer and did various other things in my life. But what I came to see, and particularly on the week before the book was supposed to be launched, I became aware that a newspaper, including yours, and the Herald Sun, had a copy of the book. Now, I didn't know how they had a copy of the book because I understood it was embargoed. And so all I got was a sort of a telephone call from someone who said, you might want to look at the Herald Sun and the Australian tomorrow. They're going to breach the embargo and publish parts of your book. Without calling me, without any kind of conversation, they've all got my numbers, they call me when they want to. And so the reason I went out was that. And I hadn't actually said anything up until that point. They had been critical of me, and so the reason I turned in that sense on that particular occasion was really I just had enough.
Because they breached a commercial agreement you had with a rival news organisation. That's the...
What I was unhappy about was a series of things I'd tried to do in my career since I'd left the Bushfire Authority, which is really things like coaching, teaching leadership courses, talking to people about managing in a crisis, sharing my own experiences. Each time I did it, I'd been criticised, and I guess I just got to the point where, probably uncharacteristically for me, I had a hit.
Ms Nixon, Candice Keller from the Advertiser newspaper. Do you have any advice or commentary around whether South Australia should introduce an independent authority to oversee police to deal with issues like corruption, and it's something Victoria is considering? Is it something that should happen here?
Look, I think what we had the government in Victoria is at the moment working through a new kind of amalgamated model, I think, for an oversight body. I think oversight bodies are important. Sometimes I wonder if I'm saying that, but I think they are important. They've been very helpful to my experience in New South Wales in the sense of the Independent Commission Against Corruption. I think they're important kind of tools because they're separate. And they also give the community, I think, a level of trust and a level of assurance that the organisation, you know, that is powerful as the police, has that oversight.
So is it something you think should be full-time or just something that comes up when there is an issue?
No, I think full-time. I've watched and, you know, throughout the book I talk about the notion of royal commissions and my concern about that. You know, I'm quite consistent, I think, about my concerns about that. What happens with an authority that is in place full time, it gets to understand what happens in that organisation. It gets to kind of realise that, you know, most of the people in the organisation are doing a decent job and trying to do their very best. So I think a full time authority with oversight responsibility and an oversight of itself is an important model for us for the future. Thank you.
Hi, Ms Nixon. Sarah Manny from the Sunday Mail. As a young woman who went from 173, was it?
Yeah.
To number one at one of possibly Australia's biggest boys' clubs, what advice would you have to women?
Look, what I think I try to do throughout the book is really give the sort of experience I've had of having a confidence, doing your work. I mean, I've studied and travelled overseas and done various roles within policing to get to a point where I actually applied to be police commissioner, I think, three times before I got the job in Victoria. So I think it is about having that confidence. More importantly, I suppose what I would be saying to women and men as well in this way is just do it as yourself. You know, the sense if you can't emulate someone else, you can learn from others, but in the end you can only do it your own way, and I think that's an important part to recognise. So it's do the work, have a great network around you, people who, you know, help you and understand you don't have to have all the answers yourself, but certainly aim high. I think we need to see more women in senior positions in corporations, on boards, in government, in parliament, because I think we get a better balance in our community and better outcomes when we do that.
Christine, John Murch, Freelance Media, Radio Notes. There has been a message from Craig Hamilton of ABC Newcastle suggesting that you've suggested that there should be a social media curfew in light of the UK riots. What was that about, and what is your view, considering it might happen in Australia, about censoring or curfewing social media outlets?
Yeah, I was asked, I forget where I was, but last week I think I was asked about the particular situation in the UK at the time, and I think we'd come to understand that the way that the locations for these had occurred, for the particular riots had occurred, had been through social media. And I guess my sense was at that stage that they were in a very difficult situation, and I think one of the things that is obviously being considered in the UK was a temporary halt, just simply a temporary halt, whilst the authorities got control back again, people got kind of settled again, because often what you need is some sort of a stop. Now, as it turned out, massive amounts of police were put onto the streets in the UK and things were able to be quietened down. But it was actually one of the strategies I thought government should consider if necessary. It wasn't about stopping it for any more than 24 hours, and clearly a lot of people would have been disrupted, but part of it was to think about how you just get a halt. And I think that what we watched in the use of social media over time was 300-400 people turning up to parties, the sort of swarming idea that you can bring large numbers of people together, and in a sense this is just a much bigger phenomena in a sense than that, and I think that was my point.
And if I get you localise that, do you think it would work in Australia? And should it work in Australia?
I wasn't advocating for it in Australia. I was advocating for it in a particular set of circumstances where you had this kind of problem. And look, I think a strong media, independent, ethical, is a foundation of our democracy.
There's Ryan from NDaily. Can I call you Commissioner?
Is that like former, really, but there you go.
You made reference earlier to the drumbeat of law and order by certain media commentators. I wonder if you'd like to comment on the drumbeat of law and order by the politicians and the coercive influence that has over police forces.
I think I suppose what I've watched over time is that way that different political interests will attempt to persuade the community and obviously, in a sense, policing, that this is a better way to go. And so I suppose what I tried to do in the book is really argue around solutions are never that simple. You know, it's never just one strategy or another. It's actually a whole series of strategies. So if you took our problems within inner city Melbourne with 300,000 young people coming in at 11 o'clock at night into the city and the violence that evoked, you know, there was a strong idea that this should be a law and order response, and it should. And we put 300 extra police a night into that environment. But I think what you have to do is, it's just not a bland black and white, this is one way to do things and there are no others. I think it's about figuring out what the problem is and then looking what the solution looks like. And so that's really my view. And when people just see it as, it's always lock everybody up, throw away the key, you know, don't let kids make mistakes, you know, those sorts of things is what bothers me, because nothing in this life is black and white.
Maria Moscarito from The Advertiser. What would you wish your legacy to be? What would you want to be remembered for? And does it upset you that you'll probably never be able to separate out your actions on Black Saturday, your choices then?
I think, look, I've thought about this a bit and I've been asked a few times. There are some people who, no matter what I did for all of my career and what I do ever since, they will always have the view. I can't do anything about that. I think there are others, though, and I've watched some lately who read the book, and I have to say one of the people I saw recently that I was a bit shocked at was Stephen Mayne, who said to me on Q&A, I've read the book, and he said, I think people need to get over it and figure out, you know, what actually happened, the way you manage, and so maybe that might be part of it. In terms of policing, what I'd like the legacy to be is that more women, more people from minority communities, people who never thought about policing but would be great police officers, think about joining. I'd like to think that policing is much better managed, much better led than it was in the past, and that I've been a part of that process.
And just going back to your previous answer, when politicians, for instance, like our former Treasurer Kevin Foley said, rack 'em, pack 'em, stack 'em, does that sort of commentary make your job more difficult, do you think, or does it make policing more difficult when politicians do stray into that very black and white commentary?
I think it's a matter, in some cases it probably does make the policing job more difficult, but, you know, the people who got elected are the members of Parliament, and they make They're the ones who, the police weren't elected. It's members of parliament, and if they then follow through those ideas with policies and legislation, then you know the police have to comply because we are in the end, you know, the servants of those governments. And I think you know part of it though, what you often find is politicians are prepared to listen, and they are in the main very decent people who are happy to kind of see the nuances and perhaps provide some support in some ways and do things differently in others.
Two more questions, please.
Katrina Stokes from the Advertiser newspaper. Today the Advertiser wrote a story saying that our state prisons are at 95% capacity at the moment, and I'm just wondering, with your experience, how do we solve this if the government has, no longer going to be opening up a new prison in Murray Bridge, and they've said shipping containers might be the solution. What is the solution here?
I'm not a corrections expert by a long shot, but I have seen cases where people have continued to build jails, and they become industries. I think I heard what your question was about. I think it's very, in the end, jail space becomes a very valuable space, and perhaps you use it for the people who really need it, and you need to have those. And I'm not suggesting they're not evil people and people who commit very serious offences and should go to jail, but I think there are also other options that sometimes are more powerful and more successful, and particularly for young people. Thanks.
I'm not a journalist, just so that you know. But I do have a question. I'd like to find out. Public perception has obviously changed since Black Saturday of what you've done, and you've obviously achieved lots of different things, but you always answer in statements. So how does it actually make you feel, all the different public perceptions?
I don't know if I can... Did you?
How does everybody's differing public perceptions make you feel? Because you actually always answer questions very well and don't talk about how you feel.
Still can't hear. How did people's...
How do people's public perceptions make you feel? Because you always...
Oh, how do public perceptions make me feel? Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose in terms of me, you know, going out to meet communities, and I still do, I think it's... people have a right to have their own perceptions, their own views of the world, and I can't do much about that in some cases. I certainly have to say, since this book's come out, I've had a lot of people come up and talk to me. I think that I talk about one example in the book where a young bloke said to me, you shouldn't have gone out to dinner, and the people on the tram told him to get off, which I thought was nice of them. I don't know what... I mean, I've never had a poll about how many people hate Christine Nixon, I've got to, get on with my life and do what I'm doing and enjoying the kind of work that I'm doing, publishing the book so people can hopefully learn a fair few lessons from it. Public perceptions are important, but I'm not a politician. I'm not standing for office. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Don't leave the stage yet. I think we've learned today that Officer 173, was that the number?
Yep.
Officer 173, your story is one of many dimensions and not a single dimension. And I think there are lessons for almost everyone in the room about what's in your book and which is your story. One of those lessons is, surely, that it wasn't a good time to be police commissioner during the what we now know as the underbelly period. That must have been a difficult time. We also understand your difficulties with the media, and they are difficulties which we probably appreciate. We may not take it from your perspective, and we could debate that further, but nonetheless, the relationship between the police and the media has always been a prickly one, and it should continue to be that way, yet there should continue to be a relationship. You emphasise consistently the need to absorb change, and I think that is probably the strongest message you had for us today, that we need to be able to change, we need to be able to absorb change and to go with the flow. You talked about the community and the need to understand the needs of the community and the accountability which every element of public life has towards the community. And we also learnt that Jackie Drewer could never be a policewoman because she's only 5 foot one.
Yes, can now.
But get up quickly.
The question was, what's my view of David Cameron asking Bill Bratton, the former head of New York, Los Angeles and Boston, to give advice on the riots and situations? Look, David Cameron should be asking a whole range of people. He should ask his own police, but I think Bill Bratton is someone who has an outstanding reputation, very measured, very reasonable individual, and I'd be taking a whole lot of advice as well.
Officer 173, this is bottle 326890, St Hugo's, Jacobs Creek. It's more than one bottle.
Yes, it is.
More than one bottle. You'll need a few friends to help you with it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for a very entertaining address. A couple of quick housekeeping matters. In a moment we're going to draw the lottery, but I remind you that you can buy Christine's book at the back of the room and she'll be happy to oblige with a personal autograph. I'd like to remind you that on September the 7th we have Andrew Robb. Andrew Robb is a former director of the Liberal Party and now the Shadow Finance and Debt Reduction Minister. I happen to be on a federal advisory committee on suicide and mental illness, and Andrew Robb, of course, is a man who tells his story in the book Black Dog Days, Public Life and Private Demons, his fight with mental illness and depression. So that will be, like Christine's today, a story with more than one dimension. And that is on the 7th of September in this very venue. And I'm going to invite Detective Inspector Brewer, all 5 foot one of her, to draw the lottery. Come up here, Jackie, and you can do it all yourself.
Okay. 4 foot 11 and three quarters.
Okay.
and diminishing. Do you want to F31, the first prize for the raffle, F31, David Place.
Jeff Timms, $300 voucher.
$300 voucher for Jeff Timms, jewellers. Is David, yes, excellent. Do we have, yeah, was it rigged?
Second prize is,
have you got the
carton of beer?
Okay, I'll just go to the bottom. F77, Nat Shepherd. Okay. And third prize?
Yes, same thing.
F18, purple. No name, but F18 is the number. If you've got a purple ticket, it might be you. Okay. That's it?
Two more.
Two more.
We've got two bottles of wine and two bottles of wine.
Okay. Green F1. Is that you, Miss Miller? Oh, it wasn't rigged, I promise. You said you never win anything. That was you. Oh, well, see if I can get yours now. Candace Keller. Not Caroline Kelly. Candace Keller. Are you here? Yes? Excellent. And is that it?
That's it. Thank you, Officer. That brings to a close today's luncheon. We're almost on time, which is remarkable. We inevitably go over, but there's a few minutes now for a bit of networking and a bit of chatting and a bit of book signing from our guest. Thank you all for coming, and I remind you of September the 7th, Andrew Robb. Thank you very much.
soul.